Thanks for joining us here on Hillbilly Solid. We're lucky today to have writer, farmer, and activist Laura Smith in the studio with us. Laura is a native of Corbin, Kentucky, and now lives on a farm with her husband, Joe Schroeder, and their children down in Jackson County, Kentucky, in a little community called Egypt. Laura is a graduate of NYU, UNC Chapel Hill, and Duke University's Center for Documentary Studies. She is the program officer for all of Appalachia for the Mary Reynolds Babcock Foundation, a 60-year-old family foundation with a mission of helping to move people and places out of poverty in the American South. Laura began her career in strategic communications with Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, working on campaigns to end mountaintop removal and efforts to spark economic transition in the region. She also serves on the board of directors at the Hyman Settlement School. That's a cause that's really near and dear to my heart. I've asked her to join us today in her role as a writer. She's published in magazines like Gravy and other publications like the New York Times, and also in her role as one of the founders of the Appalachian Food Summit. Laura, thanks so much for being here with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
First of all, why don't you tell us about the Appalachian Food Summit, what it is, what y'all do.
Great. Yeah, so the Appalachian Food Summit, we started about 4 years ago now, and it started really organically with a conversation on Facebook about cornbread. And all these people, I mean, it had like, 180 comments or something. And somebody all of a sudden said, we should get together and have a food summit. And so myself and a food writer named Ronnie Lundy, a chef named Travis Milton, and another writer named Kendra Morris got together and started planning this. And we had our first one at the Hyman Settlement School there in Hyman, Kentucky. And we attracted 75 people. We sold out. We couldn't handle any more than that. And had an all-day symposium that brought together chefs and writers and farmers and cooks and just people who are, enthusiastic about mountain cooking came out. And then we had a big dinner, big supper that night. And people loved it, and we just knew we had to continue it. So we're coming up on our third annual summit, and we've gone through a lot of growth. We're now a membership organization and are housed out of Berea College. And, yeah, it's just growing. And what we're trying to do is to celebrate our mountain foodways, traditions, and heritage while also talking about what's happening right now and helping the efforts to build local food economies in the Mountain South.
Right. So the third annual Appalachian Food Summit will happen September 16th through 18th at Berea College.
That's right.
And anybody can come to that, mm-hmm. right? And if they come to that, what will they experience?
Well, this year we always have a theme, and this year we're focusing on Appalachian routes. So we interpret that pretty broadly. So we're going to talk about everything from road food to migration routes that people took through the mountains to new immigrants to the mountains, like the Latino population. So we'll be talking about Blue Ridge tacos and things like that. Right. And what you can expect is there'll be a pretty full day of talks and conversation, followed by some site visits there in Berea. And then we'll have a huge supper, which is not to be missed.
So if they want to come to that, where do they find out, like, how to get tickets
sure.
and such?
So we have a website that's hosted by Berea College, and it's at growappalachia.berea.edu. And if you go on Grow Appalachia's site, you'll see the little tab for us, and you can connect that way. And then also on Facebook, if you search there on Facebook for Appalachian Food Summit, will come up. And the Facebook group that we have is a great way to stay mm-hmm. really up to date with what's going on.
I'm really looking forward to that, and I'm expecting that there's going to be lots of great food there.
There will be. Yeah, we're planning this year for lunch. We're going to have a food truck rodeo, so there will be food trucks that come from all over and different types of food. And then the supper is always just, like, too much. I mean, you found her on it, because we usually have three or four chefs, and they're all, outdoing one another.
Right.
So it's pretty great.
Right. Founder is one of my favorite words that people don't use enough for anybody out there who hasn't figured it out. It just means to overeat or
yes.
to sort of be a glutton.
Yes.
But it is a very rural term, mm-hmm. I assume.
Yeah.
I only have heard it in rural places. Well, what put you on the path to become such a force in Appalachian foodways? I mean, Were you always in the kitchen as a child, or take us through that?
Well, I like to eat. Started there. And, you know, some of my best memories as a kid growing up was at my grandparents' table. And I think that I had, you know, in the spring and summer, we ate out of the garden. So a typical plate would have just been like sliced cucumbers, some corn that was either fried or cream corn, but usually just fried with a lot of pepper, and then sliced tomatoes, which is like salt and pepper on them. And that was like standard plate. And then, you know, there might be cornbread, there might be a green onion or something like that too. And, you know, my grandparents did a lot of things. Like, they made shucky beans, so we always dried beans. And then we cooked those all through Thanksgiving and winter and collected mushrooms. And a lot of our family kind of recipes speak to that and speak to kind of older traditions. So it's always something that really connected me back to place. And I was always interested. A lot of our family stories revolve around food. So it's just, I don't know, it was a big part of my life growing up. And then as I got older, I found out that food's a really powerful way to talk about social issues.
Yeah. And there's just such a an emotional attachment to food.
Yeah.
I was in a conversation yesterday about kilt lettuce, which is lettuce preferably right out of the garden with green onions cut up in it, and then you pour bacon grease over it. Some people put vinegar in that as well. But this conversation became so passionate, and everybody was very particular about the different way they did this one thing or that way, and they had all these memories attached to it. So it is such an emotional and passionate subject. That reminds me of when you published in the New York Times. it was about was dressing, right? And you just tell us about
Well, so I had a family recipe. I got contacted by the New York Times, gosh, I guess it was like 2 years ago. And they did this great feature on 50 dishes from 50 states for Thanksgiving. So they wanted a dish from every state. And somehow they ended up choosing me for Kentucky to represent Kentucky. And I did my family's dressing, which is both unique and speaks to a larger tradition. So a lot of people do a cornmeal-based dressing, right? And it's been written about. I mean, it was in the Virginia Housewife and Kentucky Housewife cookbooks, like from the, you know, 1800s. So it's a real – it's something that speaks to a regional tradition. And then my family's is a little bit different because it would have originally it would have had foraged mushrooms in it. Today, a lot of times we use canned mushrooms, and it had chestnuts in it when we used to still have chestnut trees in Appalachia before the blight. And it's a dressing, meaning it's a patty. So it's not something it's not stuffing, you know what I mean, which is a big distinction. And you don't put it in the bird. You put it around the bird or can pat it out and cook it on baking sheets. And gosh, you know, I was talking to my friend Sherry Castle, who was in that issue as well. And I mean, it just elicited such a response.
I remember.
Good and bad. And I was like, oh my goodness, what did I just get into? Right. People got so upset because, you know, they really wanted things that spoke to place. And that's why they picked it. And, but when they presented it on social media, they were like, these are the iconic dishes. And so I found that especially people from, like, Louisville were really upset about it. And people were arguing, oh, it should be Derby pie and all this stuff. It's like, who eats Derby pie at Thanksgiving?
Really?
I don't know. So it was funny. But, yeah, people got passionate. And there were people who came out and were like, yeah, my family makes something similar. And then there were people, like, wanted their Derby pie and whatever.
Right. So, yeah, an emotional connection.
Yeah.
Well, you alluded to this a little bit earlier, but I know you've been really active all of your life in social justice issues, particularly civil rights and environmental justice. So can you talk a little bit about the way food aligns with that work for social justice?
Sure. Well, I think food is inherently political because I think food at its core is about power. And what I mean by that is food is about who has it and who doesn't. So there's like a very basic level of like who's hungry or who is food insecure or doesn't have access to good or healthy food. And it's also a lot about resilience and how communities get through really hard times. And you see that like in African-American foodways where people took the cuts of meat that were being thrown out and turned it into the most delicious, desirable meat and cut, right? And you see that in Appalachian foodways. I mean, I mentioned earlier shucky beans, which are, or leather breeches. It's a greasy bean, what we call a greasy bean, that you grow and then string or dry. People have different processes that they use, but you can string them up and dry them, and then you rehydrate them and cook them to death, you know. And back in the day, they would have dried those over a wood stove, and they take on kind of a smoky, meaty flavor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I say it's about power because it's like, how do you take a green bean and make it taste like meat in the middle of winter, you know? Yeah. And that's what people survived on because it was such a high protein. That, to me, is mountain genius, you know, to figure that out. And that's how you get through hard winters and hard times. It's the subsistence food that is not just like, you know, it's delicious and it's what nourishes you physically and spiritually.
Mm-hmm. This is Hillbilly Solid. I'm your host, Silas House, and we are enjoying our conversation with Laura Smith here today. Thanks for joining us. Well, you've been doing some really great writing. I just love seeing your essays, and especially in the magazine Gravy, which is a wonderful magazine that's published by the Southern Foodways Alliance. I especially love this essay that you've written about the significance of Jell-O for rural people. It's so interesting. So I'm going to ask you to read just the first few paragraphs.
Sure. Electric Jell-O. Refrigeration brought the jiggle to rural Appalachia. I've long believed in the alchemical properties of Jell-O, a powder made from ligament and bone. Add water, and all of a sudden you have a brightly colored gelatinous solid. My fascination started as a child with trips to the D&W cafeteria in Corbin, Kentucky. These outings were amazing for two reasons. One, I could get anything I wanted. Two, the dessert case never disappointed. After winding around the metal counter pushing a marble plastic tray, I was electrified by the mountains of translucent, green, perfectly cubed Jell-O, neatly portioned in parfait cups. Along with 7-Up, a cure-all tonic in my mother's house, Jell-O was a healing food. It was sustenance on a sick day home from school. And after my second child was born, I discovered that, along with the miracle of birth and the awe of a precious new life, there was a call button I could push on my hospital bed that would prompt a Jell-O delivery. I think I pushed that button more than the one that delivered pain medication, struck by wonder each time a nurse appeared with an aluminum-foiled sealed cup of orange or red Jell-O. Jell-O drove me into the archives at Berea College to explore a collection of oral histories with mountain women that documented shifting Appalachian foodways. The majority of the women were born in the 1930s and hailed from eastern Kentucky and West Virginia. The interviews highlighted traditional preservation techniques, the effects of rationing during World War II, and changes to Appalachian tables over time. That all sounded fascinating, but I was there for the Jell-O. I had heard that many of the women mentioned it in their interviews, and I wanted to know why. The voices in the archives speak of hardscrabble farm living. Families grew, put up, and cooked almost all of what they ate. Every member of the family worked subsistence gardens that provided fresh vegetables. Meat was primarily chicken, pork, or wild game that they processed to store for winter. The women recall harvesting and foraging fruit from plentiful orchards and brambles. They talk about apples, blackberries, quinces, peaches, mulberries, plums, cherries, wild grapes, persimmons, pawpaws, and raspberries. Desserts were for special occasions. Holiday treats included sorghum-covered popcorn balls, buttermilk candy, fudge, and vinegar taffy. In the summer months, they bake fresh fruits into pies and cobblers. After World War II, something happened in the kitchen. In many of the stories, Jell-O marked and divided a shift in home cooking. I came to think of time in before Jell-O and after Jell-O eras. It seems strange that Jell-O emerged suddenly as the first commercially processed food embraced by the women of rural Appalachia, especially since gelatin dishes had been popular in the United States, even in Appalachian cities, since the early 1900s. It became obvious that Jell-O stood out in the minds of rural mountain women because it signaled the time when power lines finally snaked their way to rural mountainsides. The appearance of Jell-O in remote Appalachian kitchens was a direct result of rural families connecting to mainstream American culture through the very real connectivity of going on the grid.
I love that because it's as if you can look in the cookbooks and the journals and see electrification happening because they couldn't have Jell-O before. Can you sort of briefly summarize the rest of the essay?
Sure. So I go into a little bit of the history of the Rural Electric Administration that was started during the New Deal and FDR, and kind of look at that history. And what I found was that some of the last places to get electrification were in rural Kentucky and West Virginia. And specifically Eastern Kentucky, yeah, and West Virginia, yeah. And so a lot of the women that are in this oral history collection at, that's housed at Berea College didn't necessarily get electricity until 1958 or as late, wow, as that, yeah. And so many of them would be like sophomores in high school, you know. And everybody said, I mean, everybody, the first thing they got was a refrigerator. Their mom got a refrigerator, and then they got an electric stove, because before that they'd been cooking on a wood stove. Mm-hmm. And it just radically changed stuff, because all of a sudden they could have things like Jell-O. You could refrigerate things. So, you know, it's for better and worse. It really changed the foodways of our region, because you no longer had to put up everything out of the garden to, mm-hmm, store it for winter. You know, so I think that we've lost a few things, you know, like the way that more people used to ferment, you know, cabbage, right, to make sauerkraut and put up food. But it was radically different. And then I ended up turning this into a podcast for the Gravy Podcast. And in that, I kind of expand on it a little bit to draw the comparisons between the promises and what was happening with rural electrification and what we now hear about broadband. Because everybody's, exactly, talking about broadband, yeah, now, and that it's going to revolutionize our world. Because so many Eastern Kentucky counties don't have it or still, mm-hmm, on dial-up. So it's just kind of an interesting thing. Like, there are new lines coming into the mountains, and how's that going to change what we do in the kitchen?
Right. Well, I know you're a big fan of Brett Ratliff, mm-hmm, and I am too, and that's why I played a song of his earlier in the show. Are there any other musicians in the region that you'd recommend our listeners check out?
Yeah, well, oh man, I mean, I think that you probably play a lot of them on your show, including Sam Gleaves, and, mm-hmm, you know, I love him, and I'm sure your listeners are familiar with him, and if they're not, they should be. Another young musician coming up that I love is Amethyst Kia. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever played her.
I've heard her, yeah.
Oh, she's amazing. And by coincidence, she actually played the second Appalachian Food Summit. Mm. That the town of Abington put in some money to get us a musician, and it was her. So that was so awesome. And then I just recently saw her play at Seatime on the Cumberland. I love her. And then another band is Land and House. They're based out of Asheville, North Carolina, and it's two women. One of them is my friend Sally Ann. She plays with the Black Twig Pickers. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is named Sarah Louise, and she's amazing. She has a new record out that's just a fingerstyle guitar, and man, she's awesome. She's
great.
Virtuoso.
We'll look for all those. Well, what about, we also like to give book recommendations on this show. So is there a favorite book of yours about food or a cookbook?
Yeah, so cookbooks, you know, my all-time probably favorite cookbook that deals with Appalachia is Ronnie Lundy's Shuck Bean Stack Cakes and Honest Fried,
yes,
Chicken.
It's wonderful.
It's a classic. Yeah. And if you can find that, find it. And it's, I've always loved it. And I always tell the story when I started dating my husband, I knew he was okay because he had a copy of it when he had me over for dinner and it was on the shelf. So I was like, all right, you're okay. Yeah, he probably just got it, right? And then another classic book, cookbook that I love is Edna Lewis's The Taste of Country Cooking. And it's beautiful. I mean, it's she organizes it in a way through the seasons, but she's an African-American woman from Virginia and talks, and there's just this story and beautiful writing and narration throughout it that's amazing. So I encourage people to pick that up and get to know Edna Lewis.
Great. Well, you mentioned Ronnie Lundy. Mm-hmm. She is, I think, one of the nation's best food writers, and she's also a native of Corbin, where you're from. Mm-hmm. What is there something in the water in Corbin that makes for a good food culture, do you think?
I think it's not the water, it's the chili buns that we all right. grow up on. It's yeah. chili buns and RC Cola. Yeah, I mean, I think that Corbin, as you know, it's funny, and that's, you know, I always looked up to Ronnie, and then later, and you know, got to know her and become friends and count her as a mentor. And I think that Corbin's an interesting place to study food and think about it because it's an old railroad town. Mm-hmm. And so it was a place where a lot of different people met at different times. And especially in the 30s and 40s, there was a lot of, you know, people coming from all over and gathering. And when you think about, there's a book on Kentucky country music by Charles Wolfe, and he talks about Corbin in it in the 30s and 40s, and that it was just like this hopping string band town, and people coming from all over. So I think that maybe something about that transportation history and, you know, talking about routes and different people coming in with different experiences kind of made for a great local food culture.
Yeah. And there's something happening in Corbin right now with the restaurants. Main Street has been really revitalized with these two or three really good restaurants, and people are actually going to Corbin to eat.
I know.
Which, when when we were growing up, that would have never happened.
That would have never happened, and everything had moved out to the exits, you know what I mean? And that was kind of what was happening. But yeah, no, they've just done a great thing there. They started with the farmers market and then have been kind of graduating people out into the these downtown spaces. And if you haven't been, go to the Wrigley Tap Room in downtown Corbin. Go to You and Me Coffee. Great food.
Yes. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for everything that you're doing. You are doing just really great work.
Thank you.
And I love, you know, people have this idea that social justice only happens if you're marching in the streets or, you know, things like, or, you know, going to Washington, D.C., but it happens in so many ways. You know, it happens in the way that we eat, and it happens by playing banjos and et cetera, et cetera. So I love what you're doing, and I thank you for it. So thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, we're going to close the show with one more song from the Local Honeys. The song needs no introduction because everybody out there will know it, I hope, and will most likely be able to sing along. Thanks for being with us here on Hillbilly Solid on listener-supported WUKY. And until next time, be good to one another.